Hey everyone, a quick announcement before today's episode. As we seem to mention in every episode, Fidget is an evolving experiment, and while I'm super excited about the latest thing from deep within the Fidget Labs, I've partnered with Catherine Atkinson, the registered counselor from episode 10, and we're delivering 4-week online workshops. They're a mixture of prepared content, live guided discussions, suggested homeworks, all to help you manage your BFRB. The next one starts February 28th, and to give you a sense of our content, I've also made a video. It's a process diagram that I've been developing to understand my own BFRB. I hope you check it out. Links are in the episode description. But all right, here we are, on to our episode.
Listening to Fidget, a BFRB podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Fidget. My name's Jason.
I'm Adele.
And today, holy cow, I don't even know how to introduce this guest. There are just so many things. She is a writer, a publisher, a mindfulness practitioner. She is a caretaker of a dog named Bella, I believe, a didgeridoo hobbyist. Also a consultant on the National Institute of Health, founder of the TLC Foundation for BFRBs, and current CEO of the Heart and Soul Academy, Christina Pearson. Welcome to the show.
It's so fabulous to be here. It is. It is an honor. And it's been quite a journey. It really has. And So what I believe, what I feel, what I know is that we're all interconnected, and that when, so I'm not talking through the video, I'm speaking directly to your heart, because when we are in heart space, we're all connected. So let us acknowledge that. And here we go.
And here we go. Christina, maybe some place where we can start is actually, I wanted to ask, you said you left school at 14?
I did. I went to 17 days of high school, and it was, I had started pulling 6 months before or so, before ninth grade started. I had pulled out all the hair on the top of my head, and I was absolutely terrified, because I had no idea why I was doing this behavior, and I was sure that if it was exposed, I would be ostracized for life. And I told my mom. I pulled her into the bathroom. I took off my hat. There was no hair from here up, and she said, she screamed. She screamed and fell back against the wall and said, "Why are you doing this to me?" She said, "Why are you doing this to me?" And I'm like, I thought immediately, and this is so interesting because trich, derm, all of these BFRBs, they fall into a level of a mourning for the significant pathology in our cultures. And that we are a species in evolution, and that we think we've got our act together, but we're nowhere near baked. So my mom screamed, but she did take me to a psychiatric person at a free clinic because she didn't want it to go on the records anywhere, you know, and keep it secret. And what I've learned is that secrets will kill you, and that it's fine not to share all information, but the nature of keeping secrets is not something that works in my life, okay? And that So anyway, he wrote a letter that night, wrote a letter, took it to school the next day. They said, bye. And I never went back to school. And I am a very bright person. I have a lot of potentiation capability, but it was never really cultivated much when I was younger, because my path took me into trying to drug or sedate my BFRBs. And so I was 14, was pulling severely. At 15, I started picking my skin. I was in a public bathroom in Mexico, in Chichen Itza, my boyfriend was waiting outside, and I saw in the mirror, I saw this big zit, like blackhead, and I just couldn't believe it. And so I started squeezing, and pretty soon he's pounding on the door. Are you okay in there? Are you okay in there? Because I had immediately gone into the transformation of what is microscopic becomes macroscopic, and we get lost in there. You know, whether it's hair, nails, biting your cheeks, which I used to do a lot of. So I never went back to school. I did in my 20s. I started a communication business, but I wanted to be a doctor, all those kinds of things, you know. But I couldn't do that because I was already drinking and drugging so much that I'd wonder why I couldn't do my algebra homework while I was drinking Tanqueray. You know. Anyway, at 30, I got sober. Mm-hmm. And the benefit of that was that, one, it saved my life. Two, my BFRBs got much worse because I was no longer self-medicating. I got to the place where I had to get very, very real, which was I did want to live. I wanted to live, but I felt that if I didn't get real about these behaviors, I'd opened up about everything else, but not about this. If I didn't get real about these behaviors, I would start drinking again and that would kill me. I understood that. I got that. And or I'd take my own life, you know. So I went off to an AA meeting and said I wanted to share something. I did these weird behaviors and I didn't want to get drunk over them. And I'll be gosh darn, because six people came up to me afterwards, said, oh, my mom does that or this or that. Didn't know what the name was. But that internal shift of willingness to bear what was the biggest darkness of my life opened the door to such light, such creativity, such love in this community. I was honored with having the task of creating the beginning of giving a voice to these problems. That was back in 1990. And so it's been quite a journey, 31 years, you know.
Can you explain a little bit how that came about? Because that seems like such a huge shift from someone who's holding a secret so close. And then now, where I was thinking before, we're going to talk to Christina today. I feel like you're this legend in the community where everyone has said your name at some point in every conversation.
And the legend is bigger than me because it's made up of all of our suffering. Mm-hmm. It is because what I learned, and because I was at a very willing place in my life to step into the unknown. That's mostly what people are so afraid of. Mm-hmm. Because essentially I have to say to you that just because you believe something doesn't mean it's true, because belief systems are belief systems. We could believe this or that. I had to let go of all my attachments to how I thought the world operated and trust that if I aligned the goodness in my being with the goodness for the greater good, that maybe I would be made use of. And I was. Awesome. And it was weird. I started a support group in 1990, and seven people showed up for I put a little ad in the paper. If you struggle with this and that, call this number. Mm-hmm. And I got like a few calls. But then I got a call one night from a reporter for Channel 4 up in Seattle. Hi, Christina. This is Janelle Fiorito. I'm a reporter with Channel 4 News, and we understand you may have trichotillomania, and you might be willing to talk about it. Of course, I was like, oh, my God, how did she learn my secret? Well, it had been a kind of a roundabout thing. They didn't want classic OCD. They were looking for something on trich. And I had recently been in touch with the Obsessive Compulsive Foundation, the national organization. I ended up being on their board of directors for 5 years to kind of bring BFRBs into that table. And I saw that they would not be able to really do what we needed. So I flew up and did this show. And when I got home that night, because the company that I was operating, we had just installed, and this was the beginning of voicemail and all of that stuff. So we had this big voicemail thing. I had 600 calls, people crying. My life has been, help me, help me, help my child. Oh my God, the sadness and the pain in all these calls. I spent a week calling them everybody back, and it was the best money I ever spent in my life. It cost about $1,000 because we didn't have national plans at the time, and I had a landline and, you know, wires, and I heard my life coming out of other people's mouths, my intimate experiences, the shame, the fear, the absolute desolation, and the weariness of this unmet need, you know, that we all play a role in. And at the end of the week, I had a vision. I had a bunch of things. Oh, this was also the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. The epicenter was 3 miles from my house. I was still having trouble sleeping in a building, because when your whole world becomes liquid, you suddenly lose your ground. And so there had been a series of things that had happened, I understand today, that set me up to have what's called a peak experience or spiritual vision, however you want to look at it. And I had this amazing, amazing, most beautiful episode of my entire life, where I was given the gift of hurtling through space and time. This is all I know. And ultimately seeing the beauty of my own nervous system as a creation of divinity, as a creation of the light, the love that wants to embody. And what I learned was that, oh my God, look at that. That's me. Even though I'm so messed up and screwed up and I have no whatever. Wow. And I felt the wind of spirit blow through me. And I was fully accepted. I'm a cherished being in my being. I didn't know that. I mean, not like I did that day. And the funny thing was, I saw, it was like a flower with these lights and colors and effervescence and radiance that I don't have the words for. And that was that my soul was being given the opportunity to be in this nervous system. It's so incredible. And then I looked up and I saw all these stars, like universes of stars. And I knew that they were just like me. And that was you guys. That I was seeing our nervous systems as an unfolding attempt to become conscious. But I also learned, when love has a need, and we have a deep need, love rises to meet that need. It does. And it's not for me to say in what form it will happen for you or for me. I don't know those things, but I do know when I ask for help, I don't get to say, I only want it from this area. I want to be helped, but not through medication. I only want to be helped through diet, or it has to be Jesus that saves me, otherwise I'm not a Christian, or, you know, whatever it is. We have to be willing to surrender all our concepts of what my recovery will look like, because I haven't gotten there yet. Mm-hmm. So why am I projecting and narrowing down that spectrum? So that night I said, well, how do I reach the children? I mean, after seeing this beautiful thing, because I understood that we had to reach the children. A problem was, as a recovering addict and eighth grade dropout, I realized that you had to make an institution in the world. You had to, because you don't reach kids by chatting. You reach kids through certain channels. You want to reach the pediatricians, the caretakers, the parents, the teachers, the nurses, which means you have to have a very scientific foundation. That was why I set up TLC as phase one. Phase one was about creating an entity in this universe that would create the ability to validate that these disorders deserve rigorous scientific study and acknowledgement about the amount of pain that they inflict on people. Hmm. And we did that. We're able to actually, because I called up NIMH, and I said to them, I said, why don't we get any money? And the director, Tom Insel, at the time, he said, well, we don't know what the public health impact is. You show us, you prove to us that there is significant public impact, and then we'll take a look. Mm-hmm. Boom.
You got to work.
Well, we got to work. And in 2006, the TLC Scientific Advisory Board collaboratively published the first real data set on the impact of these things socially, financially, emotionally, those kinds of things. And that was the beginning of getting some, the first over $1 million grant was made to pediatric trichotillomania. Mm-hmm. So it was the beginning of validating that, yeah, it's not all just in your head and we need to learn more. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, the BFRBs kind of fall between Tourette's, which is a motor tic disorder, let's say, mm-hmm. and OCD, which is a risk aversive disorder. Mm-hmm. Don't want to take risks. And we're somewhere in the middle sensorily. So that was good. But in my heart, I tell you what really heals us. Yeah, therapy is great. Medications can be useful. I'm all for these things if you feel that they are good for you. Mm-hmm. But I will say, ultimately, it's lovingness that is what we need.
Christina, I feel like, you know, in listening to you, into your talk, and the reason why I wanted to start with your education is this theme of feeling like you needed to do it yourself. Like, I think there's this, like, unorthodox, like, independence of, you know, like, you have this vision for what it is that, yeah, maybe is missing in the world, and you want to start it. I think last time we were chatting, you described yourself as a starter, but not necessarily a finisher. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, Adele, I wanted to ask you, like, do you feel like when you go about things, are you, like, how much are you, like, sticking to the existing process and, like, you know, flipping through textbooks versus, like creating something unorthodox or for yourself? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about?
Well, what I've been learning about myself is that I love the process of creating something new. Part of the reason I was so excited to talk to you, Christina, as well, is because I can see that you've created things and then you've moved on to other things. And I think that there's a lot of beauty in that. Like, I think we need people who do both things, who start things, and also people who are really good at staying in one place and doing it for a long time. You know, like, they're kind of maybe not always compatible, because I think they take different types of energy, different interests. And I guess, Jason, to answer your question, I find that I do things better when I can have the freedom to do them in my own way. Mm-hmm. And that's also when my passion for them comes out. And often I've found myself, as a passion project is starting to get restricted by some of the expectations, or I don't know, sometimes it just becomes a bit more tedious or routine, then I start thinking of all the other things that I want to start. So yeah, I think that is where I'm at on the spectrum. But I also think that sometimes it's really difficult, because I'm also someone who likes to meet people's expectations, exceed people's expectations. So I've never really been a rebel in that sense. Like, I want to try new things, but I want to do them yeah, in a way that I'm still like close-ish to what exists. Like, I don't know. I'm not, that's hard for me to sort of break rules in that way. Does that make sense?
I'm a very selfish person. And yet I give. But I'm selfish because I finally recognized that I do better when the world around me is doing better. So by helping to make things a little ease some of the pain and agony going on around me, I'm a little happier because people are not so freaking out. And this comes back to that people pleasing. It comes back because, of course, I want to please people. I want everybody to feel okay so that I can be okay. The problem with that model is that it's not real, because it's not my job to make everybody okay. It's my job to be the best me I can be. And me is, I'm still unfolding. Okay. And it's, when we take the risk to not be defined by what we think is expected of us, and instead respond directly to what is happening, there's a chance for a real transformation in how we navigate. But we're not taught that. You know, the Buddha has a great line, waking up or becoming, you know, a conscious being is like swimming upstream against a strong current. And the current is always coming towards us to take us back into automaticity, you might say, back into the routines that really filter out the magical possibilities. I don't want to just be a worker bee. I'm not. But that's kind of our since the Industrial Revolution, education, everything has been programmed to kind of move us into becoming part of this machination. And that is what's killing the planet. And actually, the planet's going to be fine. Whether the species makes it or not is another question. Because no mammal defecates in its own nest except us.
You know, on that line, I think something that I've been struggling with, I am struggling with this idea of fitting into this, like operating in a system that, like, here were the expectations for me and following the line and following the template and checking all the boxes versus, yeah, like swimming upstream. I guess the feeling that I've been struggling with is like an element of like self-doubt, of, you know, it takes a lot of effort to swim upstream, and every inch that I fight for, it's like, is this worth it? Is this worth it? Is this worth it? Should I be doing this? What if I could just let go and fall back into the nice, happy pool?
Well, let me bring you back to a natural, think of salmon as they try to swim back and spawn. I mean, they get battered, they get beaten, some of them die. Okay. But they fight because the urge to manifest the future is such a strong drive, and it powers almost everything that living beings do. Self-doubt, I think, is a good thing, because if you didn't have any self-doubt, you'd be really full of yourself. So it's important to have some checks and balances. And for me, I have a group of friends, mostly women, who I deeply trust in terms of putting my stuff out there, getting it massaged and getting feedback, and then making my own decisions. And that's a very different model than I'm looking for someone to tell me what to do, because I'm not. And I wasn't then either. What I knew was that we needed some activity. We needed to begin the process. And we needed to begin to break down this juggernaut of public denial, of species denial of the danger and damage all around us and in our families. And I mean, I could go on and on, but
on that note of this drive and this swimming upstream, I think one thing I see in common with the two of you is that your drive to address BFRBs, to address the suffering caused by BFRBs, seems to, I mean, it's so powerful and is leading to the creation of things, the conversations, the creation of community. I'm curious about, have you noticed connections between the work that you're doing to support BFRBs and your own experience of BFRBs? Sort of where my thinking is coming from is when I think of times when I've been really passionate about something and driven to do it, but also holding that self-doubt, it's such a delicate balance between being driven and facing the risks. And then maybe that leads to some, my BFRB affecting me a little more, but then not doing it, my BFRB affects me a little more, or maybe a lot more, because I'm not following what I need to be doing. So I was just reflecting on that.
Well, you know, you hit on some fantastic points, because the end of this vision process that I underwent was, I understood, I said, where does this all come from? All this beauty and the desire to connect and on and on. And I got a really clear answer. I kind of fell backwards in my psyche all the way down into a river of such profound love that there's no words for it. And I understood BFRBs actually come from a place of love. It's coming, but it's kind of blind love, because it doesn't know quite what to do, but it's searching for comfort for the being to help it navigate in a nervous system that hasn't been taught how to be in. And, you know, all these other species, they just get born and they have like intrinsic history, you know, like a baby turtle knows to go in the water and swim. How does it know that? And I do have a higher power. There's big higher powers than me, that's for sure. And I have learned that, can't define that exactly, but it came down to trusting that there is something so powerful in the nature of good itself, in the nature of freedom, in the nature of connection, in the inherent desire to connect and see and be seen and hear and be heard. And when you take a group of human beings, I think it was Terence McKenna that talked about this. I can't remember. Some guy was talking about, you get 500 people in a room, give them all a little piece of paper, tell them write down their deepest fear. It's going to come back in some form of, what if I'm not lovable? Mm-hmm. What if I'm not good enough? And that our deepest fear is, wait, our deepest desire is to be seen and heard, to have something to offer our community, to have a sense of worthiness. And many of us with BF, we have shitty self-worth, okay? Let me just put it that way. People used to say to me, well, how can you just talk to these people all day long? They're in such pain and you don't even have answers for them. I said, well, because I see the beauty behind it. I see the beauty behind what is happening. Mm. And it is worth laying one's life down for. Mm. Because why not?
I'm almost reminded of those like attachment styles. Are you familiar with the attachment styles? The like avoidant, the secure, the anxious.
Yes.
And I think something I worry about for myself is, yeah, like, you know, Adele, here's this passion project. I'm investing myself in this BFRB, this like connecting with others, building this community. But then I, you know, it's like something I care about, you know, I love so much, but then with, you know,
it like elevates the stakes. And then I'm worried about messing up. I'm worried about, oh, like, who am I going to piss off? Or, you know, again, that imposter self-doubt kicks in. And then I think that's what's triggering my BFRB. But really, I think I, at a certain point, I recognized, like, when I was in my like corporate job or whatever, I still had that same level of care and anxiety. And I was still like worried about these, like, let's be honest, meaningless emails. And at a certain point, that's where I got frustrated. It's like, I can't like stop caring. Like, I'm going to put in high quality work no matter what. So it's either I'm going to pick at my skin for this meaningless email, or I'm going to pick at my skin for the potential to, like, you know, help others. And so I think that's what.
So come back to this moment right here. You know, our mind, it's so wonderful to have a mind capable of imagination and projection and all these things, but really, and Eckhart Tolle says it well, the point of power is in the present moment. Coming back to right now and being in this nervous system, feeling our energies flowing. BFRBs are, for me, a signal that the system is out of balance, that there's a need, and that there's a mourning. The manifestation of the hair pulling and the skin picking is a behavioral sign of mourning. It's the separation of self from all that is. There's a break in there for all of us in certain ways. And the challenge is to, how do we live in this world and do what we need to do to take care of ourselves and our loved ones, and also understand that we are radiant beings that are learning how to be here. And that all I know is that everything is connected, and that I have doubts every day. They just don't run my life anymore. And what I learned was that if I didn't do this work in BFRBs, I would be betraying myself and God and the universe as a whole. Because if I went back to my old life and just did my regular routine and made money, and that I would be diminished. And that our job is to not be diminished, but to do that together. And I have a lot of business experience, and business is hard, because it used to be that you had a leader and the leader would rule. Well, that doesn't really work anymore, because we're all individuating into powerful beings with deep insight and deep gifts, and everybody deserves to radiate. So, and then I, you know, was a nonprofit and all that. Yes, that was quite the experience. And what I learned is that I would rather work with a group of people that made decisions together, basically with a general consensus, with a conscience, on behalf of who they're making those decisions for, as opposed to what I see as the next step for our community is those of us who are impassioned about this stuff, that we get together and we just shine, and don't try to block out somebody else's shine. And because that's what happens in business, you know, you have to jockey for position. And I don't believe that we need to jockey for position. I believe that we need to get in touch with our own skills. What are my essential skills? And then when I identify them, I can look around and see a niche that I can put them in that's fulfilling for me and for the niche. Like when I decided to start this organization, that now they won't even talk to me or anything. It's very interesting. sign of the pathology right there of the of our culture, not the individuals, but the cultural need to have control and to keep secrets. And don't let so-and-so talk to so-and-so. I'm like, what are you hiding? What are we hiding? What am I hiding?
Well, that's, I think, what I've been thinking about is like how in my life I've like blocked my own shine, right? Mm-hmm. Like in what ways have I like gotten in my own way because I didn't think I was good enough, or I was, you know, I wasn't allowed to do this. So yeah, and it's, you know, circling back to self-doubt is that's really like the hole that I dug for myself, that it didn't allow the shine to happen. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you can't believe your own thoughts, you know, especially when they're about yourself. That's what I learned. In fact, you know, I'm not my thoughts. My thoughts generate like electrical currents.
Yeah.
And it's and I can then place my awareness in the thoughts and get swept away. But I can also pull my awareness and watch the thoughts arise. Took years, mm-hmm. but just watching them arise, and then you realize 90% of them are like brain fluff, bullshit, mm-hmm. and that anything I think about myself is suspect, and I cannot trust it. I have to check it with sources in the world to get a sense of, am I navigating okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's a process that we don't teach each other, how to check yourself in that way. You know, there's a great, great, great story. I think I told this to you, Jason. There was this, I listened to this on the radio on NPR years ago. Some researchers were following some Aboriginal nomadic people in either in Australia or New Zealand. I don't remember. And they were following, I don't know, there was a small group of people. They had some animals. They drug things. They didn't even have wheels. They drug them on the animals, pulled their stuff around. And every now and then this group would stop, middle of the desert. Sometimes there was water. Sometimes there wasn't. So the three guys that were following this tribe, they weren't supposed to talk directly to them. But they did have a contact, and they got permission from their overseers to talk to their contact in the tribe. And they asked him, we see that you go and then you stop. Why do you stop? No food, no shade. He says, oh, we stop so that our souls can catch up. And we live in a society that says, if you don't produce, you're not worthy. Mm-hmm. And that is really, really, really sick. I love sharing my opinion because I couldn't used to do that. I had to be very careful running a national nonprofit not to scare people away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you go to a doctor and say, you know, I saw this beautiful thing. I sped through the universe. I saw love unfolding, and I want you to help me. That ain't going to fly. So it's about language. And this BFRB community is still struggling with basic language. Because when we develop the language to communicate effectively, it will enrich the whole world because we are, these behaviors are between the primal self and the conscious self and then the potentiated greater self. Okay.
There's a couple of things that you've talked about and that I think the overarching theme I'm getting is connection to self, being aware in that way. And the two that I'm thinking of are, one, mourning the self, I think, is a really interesting idea. I haven't really heard about BFRBs talked about that way. And as soon as you said BFRB as a form of mourning or connected to mourning, it made me think actually of the BFRB conference last year when it was my first time attending and it was virtual. And in the comments, people started sharing, like one person said, oh, my BFRB started when I lost my father. And then someone else said, oh, it also started for me when I lost a family member. And all these comments started coming in a way that I had, like I'd always thought of BFRBs related to big changes, because for me, it arose when I moved overseas and it was really challenging. But this idea of mourning, I think actually mourning the self connects to this idea of like the loss of someone important in your life. Because I mean, in a way you're losing a version of yourself connected to that. But also losing a version of yourself connected to a place. If you move, like a lot of people develop it when they move, experience a big move, or losing a version of yourself as you go through puberty because you become an adolescent. And I mean, yeah, I just find that really, really insightful. I don't know if Jason, there's this mourning of the self is something you relate to at all, or what you think of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's so interesting. And I really, I think in general, yeah, maybe I view BFRBs as like a regulation mechanism of like, okay, mm-hmm. here we have this emotion and our BFRB is there as like an attempt to process it. And I think I would agree that maybe as a society, we don't necessarily know how to mourn. And I also want to link this to that point, Christina, you made about language and how we need to figure out how to communicate these ideas and these emotions and these feelings. And I think really, Adele, that's why connecting with you was such an important part in my BFRB journey, was because now for the first time I had someone to like practice the language or like to begin to try to communicate, because it was always so lost in my own head. And so with that, I feel like the thing that I am mourning is, yeah, the mourning that I am disconnected from myself or the person that I want to be, right? And that is the, also something you mentioned, Christina, is like you have to be suspicious of any thoughts that you have of yourself. Like, I think that in and of itself is like, that's so true. Because I had this narrative of the person that I thought I was, but that was just so not me. And that was the sadness there, that I didn't know how to understand and find that language. So I think that's maybe how I would answer your question, Adele.
Parents, how do I put this? You know, the whole process of mirroring and how children learn by what they see and feel from those that are with them. If I am a human child and I am born or left at the side of the jungle and some great apes or wolves or whatever takes me in, I will never fully potentiate as a human being because I don't have the mirroring available. And we are changing. We think of ourselves as evolved. Oh my God. We're so brand new. If you look at the geology of life on, or the timeline of life on this planet, humans have appeared, like, if all life on this planet is 60 minutes, we showed up in the last second, in the half second of that second. That's how new we are compared to so many lives. Yet we've had such a dramatic impact, and we have to begin to take responsibility for that. And we are. But the thing about parenting is that my mom loved me. I know that. She loved me, but she was also so wounded herself that she couldn't see all of me, because she couldn't allow all of herself to be present because she hadn't gotten that kind of cultivation. So when you have broken people raising broken people, you get more broken people. And we have to come back to the basics of, it's like this whole American dream. Get wealthy. Personal wealth means freedom. Well, I've learned that's not really true. Mm-hmm. I have friends that are very, very wealthy who are not happy at all. and some that are. But the point is that we are in this together. My BFRBs forced me to get real if I wanted to live. And to actually, I have almost 30 years now of really strong recovery. I have certainly had behavior throughout the years, but not much. And I know how to get back on track, and I know why it's worth getting back on track. And this is the message to us. We do recover. We can change. And no, it's yes. And there's lots of things, factors that can help, but not if you don't use them. Tools are no, you can know all the tools in the world and they don't do you a damn bit of good because you're not applying them. So we do have a growing body of knowledge, but for me, it's all a spiritual journey, really, all of it, everything. And by spirit, I mean the part of being that is not quantified by an ability to measure it by science. I love science. Science is another way to identify the processes occurring in this magical world, but it's just a language. Mm-hmm. It's not the end.
I think something just listening to you talk, Christina, is like this, the security or like the confidence in which you've like identified your own identity. And I think, you know, you're a self-described like hippie, you know, like you got you're playing your didgeridoo. And I think, you know, you're like unapologetic about it. Like there's this like integrated self. And I think Adele, like I'm reminded of in our conversation with Allison, your therapist, she was talking about like how you were in this dance program and you kind of exited this dance program and maybe coming back to this idea of mourning. Like, I don't know if you were like mourning this identity, this self that you had of, oh, I don't necessarily know who I am outside of dance. Maybe this is as you were as a teenager. So I don't know, how are you navigating this like spiritual journey, if you will, of like coming to know the person that you are?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's something that I've been struggling with actually maybe my whole life. Maybe it's a whole life journey. But I think I've noticed it more and more in recent years because I've made the conscious decision to step away from things that I thought defined me, because I found myself attaching so much of who I am to situations in which I'm producing something. So you were talking about being productive earlier. And I think a really big challenge in my life in recent years, and I think for a while to come, is trying to detach this sense of what is my identity in relation to what I'm doing, but in a productive way. And so leaving the dance program, that was huge, because being a dancer was how I defined myself. I mean, we attach these labels to ourselves. And I think in my teenage years, saying, okay, maybe I'm not a dancer in that way. Or I said, I'm not a dancer anymore, but I eventually learned that I am a dancer. But what that looks like is very different than what I imagined in the beginning. And then over every year, I'm experiencing this kind of letting go process, because I think what's happening is I'll let go of something and then I attach myself to something else and I say, okay, this is who I am. And then I realize that's not the whole picture. Like there's more. And so then I mourn the detachment from that. And so I guess eventually I would like to be at the point where I don't necessarily have to define myself by this attachment to, oh, I host the Fidget podcast. Like that's who I am, you know, or I started this, but feeling whole regardless of what I'm producing and having more of that integration with myself, so that, you know, these are all just facets and they're moments in time along this journey. But yeah, I find it really challenging. And I think I'm constantly telling I'm noticing in my school program right now that I'm finding very hard and having doubts occasionally about what I'm doing with my life academically. I notice myself telling myself stories where I'll go back and I'll think, okay, this is logical because in undergrad, I took this class and then I did this and this, and I'm like reviewing why it is that I'm allowed to be here right now. It's like, I have to rationalize it. So I know that I'm not quite where I want to be yet because I'm still relying on these stories. So yeah, it's process.
One of the images that was very helpful to me was the idea of a spinning jewel, because I am a diamond in the rough and my life has begun all these things that have created different facets, and that each facet is phenomenal to itself, but all the facets are me, and that as I learn to be more grounded, it's easier for me to access my own different facets and for different purposes and different ways in life. There's no reason to define ourselves in any. I did think once that if I put all my psychiatric diagnoses after my name, initials, everybody would think she's so smart. I went, you know, Christina Pearson, MD, but not for medical doctor, for major depression. Christina Pearson, MD, DT, OCD, BFRB. I mean, you put them all out there, you'd have like 30 letters. And that is both a blessing and a curse. I know that probably one of the greatest things of my own journey is learning how to become my own best friend and be kind to myself and to not judge myself so harshly. Or when I do, which is constant, to understand that that's not real. I don't have to listen to that narrative. I can buy into it, but it's really much more a cultural program that we're meshed in. Because I myself am an unusual, startling drop of light. That's it. And, you know, other things happen, but that's about it.
Yeah, I like that really like that diamond imagery. Mm-hmm. And going back to this idea of like shining, like, you know, when you shine a light into a diamond, it like refracts and then it allows you to, like, you know, like disco ball all around.
And just imagine if that light was shining on millions and millions of beautiful spinning jewels, and that's our core. Mm-hmm. And all of that harmonizing then becomes a prayer of celebration. And the thing about mourning is I had to mourn the life I didn't have. I had to mourn that because my BFRB stole a life that I could have led, but they also brought me to a life that I couldn't have imagined. Mm-hmm. So that's some of the divine humor, you might say.
Well, and I think to my identity, sort of, Adele, as you were kind of reflecting through your journey, I feel like how I've been interacting with that, especially recently, is like just kind of like my racial and cultural identity of just being like, I don't know, you know, if you think about all the acronyms that you add on and, you know, you add on your pronoun, he, him, a way that I've been like trying to introduce myself these days is like, oh, I'm second generation Chinese Canadian. And I think for so long, that was a part of myself that I hid, I was embarrassed by, I tried to like assimilate into whiteness. And very much I erased this component of myself, like I pretended to not know how to speak the language. You know, my parents put me in piano class and I, you know, hated that. And you know, I really, like, I was resentful of, like, you know, people assumed that I'm good at math, you know, in school. And then, like, and then the fact that I was good at math, like, it wasn't like helping my case.
Damn it.
I went on a date. Like, it was like through online dating, and the girl just like assumed, she's like, oh, like, let me guess, you're an engineer. And I'm like, I am, like, but that, like, that was like such an erasure of like the person that I was, is like, that's the only, the facet that they saw me as. And so I think those experiences have made me be like, so like resentful of yeah, the person that I am. And so, you know, coming back to this idea of mourning, like, I think that's the self that I'm mourning is I'm the person who I am, I've had to erase. And I've realized something that really triggers my BFRB is like when people underestimate me, and when they underestimate me, that's where I like kick in. And it's like, no, like, let me show you, let me prove it to you. And I think, you know, Adele, you asked that question of being in this like creative space, being really passionate about BFRB stuff. It's like, I'm like working so hard because I'm like trying to prove it to these like skeptical people, you know, these doctors, these scientists, these things like, oh, BFRBs, they're not important. What's the public health impact? And I'm like, no, it has such I'm trying to prove it to them.
Yeah.
And I think that it's time to stop proving it to others. I think it's time to take the reins and say, let me learn to use these skills. Let me use them in the way that is really most effective. Okay, we have incredible levels of empathy, incredible levels of sensitivity. How can we train ourselves to be better human beings because of these sensitivities? And so I'm tired of all the, I don't want to, I'm just like, but it's a difficult place to be where we are right now, because we are beginning to see some movement. We're only at the beginning, you know. And I realized when I started TLC, I made a 20-year commitment that night, because I looked at my notes and I said, it's going to take a human generation just to begin the process of making a little change, because this is deep primal stuff. We're up against the realities of, are we energy or are we form? Okay. Mm. And form is conform. Energy is everywhere. So am I a conformed being? No, not anymore. Not really. But that threatens the cultural roots of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that the human mind seems to want to grab onto a static kind of, oh, it's safe now, so this is how it should always be. But that's not life. Life is constantly changing. And and I love, Adele, and you were talking about that in terms of these transitions that we go through, whether it's moving. And I always look at BFRBs, I always look for, and there's lots of abuse around it and stuff, but more I look for in somebody's personal evolution, I look for where they're overwhelmed, where they got so overstimulated that they began to have this need for a different way of dealing with energy. I've always seen BFRBs as the physiological translation of a neuroemotive charge. So you go wherever you want with that, but so we are kind of like Alice down the rabbit hole, you know?
Yeah. I hate to do this, but I'm looking at the time, and
I know
I have
a meeting at 1:00. So
you have a meeting, so let's not even try to summarize, but maybe...
And I apologize.
No, you know, don't.
I'm so, I think in very unusual terms sometimes, and it's difficult to pull me in and make me focus. And I just enjoy this opportunity. Oh my God. And I'm like, okay, love you. Okay, you're coming with me.
No, that totally okay, Christina. We feel the love, we feel the energy. Thank you for taking us on.
Thank you
journey.
So much. The number of times I got goosebumps during this conversation, I can't, it's a lot. It's so many things to think about. And
you know what I learned about that feeling of goosebumps? You know, I always used to hear people talk about, the Holy Spirit touched me. Well, I think that's what they're describing. Mm-hmm. I think that the sense, when we get that wash of energy that is true and is resonant with the universe itself, that that is validation, first, that you're on the right track, mm-hmm. and second, it used to be described as being touched by the Holy Spirit.
There you go. The body knows.
The body knows. So I hope to the listeners out there that you also had some of that resonant spirit with you. Thank you so much for coming, Christina. And maybe that's another episode of Fidget. If we want to hear, did you have goosebumps? You can reach out to us at our email, which is at fidgetpodcast@gmail.com.
You can also send us your ideas for the show, what topics you'd like us to cover. We're hoping to just broaden the conversation and respond to questions that you might have or ideas you might have. We'd like to thank Cheyenne for our logo and Thomas for our music, of course. And you can support us in various ways, including supporting our Patreon. And you can also leave us a review, because that helps us reach more people. So thank you for that.
Thank you all, and thank you, Christina. But until next time, stay tuned.